I'd like to call the meeting to order. Thought I was on. I'd like to call the Jobs and Economic Growth, Finance and Policy meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, February 2nd. We do have a quorum. Members, I just want to take a moment. This is, we're working through some of the bugs of our very first hybrid meeting and appreciate everyone that could join us in person. Thought it might be nice if we just took a couple of minutes to reintroduce ourselves. We have a couple of new members on the committee that we can do, but we'll just go ahead and start. I'm Eric Pratt. I represent Senate District 55, which is Scott County, so the communities of Shakopee, Prior Lake, and Jordan. Senator Champion, why don't we go with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Senator Bobby Joe Champion, Senate District 59, which is North Minneapolis, the North Loop, downtown, Bryn Mawr, and Elliott Park. I'm the ranking minority member, so thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak.
And we have Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Karin Housley, I represent Senate District 39, which is Stillwater, the surrounding St. Croix Valley, and Forest Lake, and this is my 10th year in the Senate.
And Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jason Rarick, I represent District 11, that is all of Pine County, all of Kennebec County, or half of Kennebec County, all of Carlton County, and a little bit of St. Louis County, so right between the Twin Cities and Duluth.
And we can welcome Senator Utke as a new member to the committee, but a returning member to the committee.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to had to take a year off, and now I've come back. So thank you for letting me do that and having me back. But I represent Senate District 2, which is up in northwestern Minnesota, and I have all or part of eight counties from Northern Wadena and Otter Tail County all the way up to the Canadian border, including the northwest angle. So it's that stretch of Minnesota.
And Senator Putnam, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Eric Putnam. I represent St. Cloud, Waite Park, St. Augusta, Haven-Minden Township.
As we do with hybrid meetings, we sometimes have members that are in remote locations. Senator Herr, I see on. Welcome back to the committee, Senator.
Yes, I'm glad to be back, Chair Pratt. I'm Senator Fong Herr, representing District 67, which is the heart of Eastside St. Paul. And in my district is the community like Dayton Bluff, Battle Creek, Payne and Phelan, and Greater Eastside. Thank you.
And new to the committee is Senator Johnson Stewart. Welcome, Senator Johnson Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairman. I'm Ann Johnson Stewart. I am a newly elected to District 44, Plymouth, Minnetonka, Woodland, and I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
And Senator Dreheim just joined us. He needs a few minutes to connect, so maybe we'll come back to him in just a couple of minutes while he gets a chance to get his PC set up. But members, I want to thank you again for being in person. We're going to try these hybrid meetings. The Senator, or Representative Knorr and I held the Jobs and Labor Conference Committees in person with Senator Rarick and Representative Eklund. Thank you. we found it to be really helpful in getting our work done. In fact, I think it really helped us come out with a good conference committee bill. And so, as we start to come back together and get to be more normal, it'd be nice to have as many of us here in person. We're going to ask that our testifiers show up in person whenever possible. And we'll continue to work through this, but maybe Senator Dreheim, you can just hop on the microphone and introduce yourself while we're waiting for your video.
Thank you, Chair Pratt, and apologize for being late. Rich Dreheim, Senator from District 20, representing parts of Le Sueur, Scott, and Rice Counties. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Members, we just have one topic on the agenda today, and it's been a topic that has really, in some ways, dominated the conversation during the interim, and that is around unemployment insurance. We've asked Commissioner Grove and his team to provide us an update on the state of the unemployment trust fund, and as well as some other information. And so what I'd like to do is give the commissioner a chance to get through his presentation and then open it up for questions from members. So with that, Commissioner Grove, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. It's good to see you. Thanks for having me, and it's good to see so many familiar faces here. Thank you for your leadership over the past 6 months. It feels like we almost were just meeting, given that the last session wasn't so long ago. But it's a thrill to be here. And of course, as the chair said a moment ago, no topic more important than our state's unemployment insurance trust fund, which we're eager to walk through today. You have seen the governor's proposal here as it rolled out in the budget rollout that we've done over the past few weeks. I'm sure we'll talk more about that in the future, but what the chair has asked us to do today, and I think it's really great, is just to get a basic foundation in how unemployment insurance works, how the trust fund works, how the taxes work. It's a pretty complex system. It's an extraordinary system. It kept Minnesota afloat during a really difficult year, but making sure we're all kind of on the same page of how this works, I think really is the goal of our presentation today. And then from there, eager to collaborate with you all on where we go from here. So we'll bring up some slides here. My colleague, Daryl Dan, our legislative director, will present. I'll ask my colleague, Acting Deputy Commissioner of Workforce Services, Evan Rowe, to tag team this with me as we walk through some of the details, but I'll get us started here. And I'll start just by, as we go to the first slide, talking about kind of the history of the program and the reason that unemployment insurance exists. This is one of the oldest social service programs in our nation's history. It was started by the federal government, but it's administered by states. So every state administers this slightly differently. There are federal statutes that guide sort of the overall program, but then each state takes those statutes, of course, abides by them, but adapts it to the way their state wants to run specific pieces of this. So we can get into some of those differentiations as we go through here. But in Minnesota, we say that, you know, really the purpose of the program is to promote the public good by providing workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own a temporary partial wage replacement to assist them to become re-employed. And that no fault of their own is, of course, the key phrase there. We're trying to help workers who are laid off based on unforeseen circumstances. And of course, a pandemic is right at the center of that definition, even if the scale and scope of this is something I think no one ever fully anticipated. You're eligible for UI if you've been laid off, but also quits or discharges where the worker did not cause that quit or discharge. And that's developed, analyzed on a worker-by-worker basis. It's a temporary program as well. Obviously, you have a period of time to get this assistance as you look for your next role. And that period in a lot of states, as it is in Minnesota, is 26 weeks. So half a year is the period of time that you're eligible for those benefits. You don't get paid your full wage while you're out. You get paid either half or up to a maximum of $820 a week. So it's not a full wage replacement, but a partial one. And to become re-employed, you have to be able to work, available for work, and actively seeking work. So you got to be up and able and moving and looking for work, and that's what makes you continue to be eligible, and it's what we expect of our folks who are on unemployment insurance. So that's kind of the broad sense of the purpose of the program. I want to talk a little bit about how the program is funded. I think everyone here knows there's an unemployment insurance trust fund, but how does that get funded? How does that work? Here are the basics. A state payroll tax is assigned to Minnesota employers who employ anybody in our state. And that payroll tax goes into a trust fund that is designed to respond to good times and bad in our economy and help workers get the assistance they need when they need it. Now, for most employers, majority of employers in our state, you are taxed on a regular basis based on your experience of hiring and firing workers. But there are some organizations, hospitals, nonprofits, schools, what have you, who operate on a reimbursement system. So they don't pay into those taxes every quarter, but they can take advantage of the system by paying into it on an individual worker basis when they do engage in a layoff. And so this is meant to help those industries that are less in the for-profit space navigate their way through a system where they can help their workers, but in a slightly different manner. But it's those tax-paying employers across our state that fund the trust fund. It is held by the U.S. Treasury and can be only used for paying benefits. So it can't be diverted by states for other reasons. We can't legislate and say, hey, we want to use the trust fund to build a road or a bridge. This is a very specific use, a very specific fund, and the Treasury guides that very closely. So that's sort of the basics of how the fund works. And we'll get into the details on the taxes in a minute. So if you have questions, which I anticipate folks will, we'll get into some of those specifics here in a moment. But I want to back up for a second and just talk about how this system went through a pandemic, because that is, I think, the most trying and tested period for unemployment insurance in our nation's history. And it bears just kind of remembering exactly what we all just went through as it relates to our unemployment insurance system. So as you all know, back in March of 2020, we lost about 416,000 jobs in a period of about 1 month in our state. And by the time we were through, almost 1 in 5 Minnesotans had applied for unemployment insurance. 1 in 5. You know, most Minnesotans who applied probably never even thought they would ever even need to engage in this system or apply for unemployment insurance. Most of your constituents had to figure out what the heck this thing even was, right? Because they never imagined they'd have to apply for it. But here we were with millions and millions of people across the country and hundreds of thousands here in Minnesota applying for and receiving benefits. And what we realized during the pandemic, both the legislature and the governor, is that the system wasn't quite set up for a pandemic. There were unique things we wanted to change to make it work better in a time of extraordinary economic calamity. And so together, the legislature and the governor worked to ensure a couple things happened. First of all, that the waiting week that exists in unemployment insurance went away. In other words, you usually have to wait a week until your first check comes in when you apply for unemployment insurance. We all did away with that so we could pay workers right away. We suspended certain eligibility requirements to make sure that if you were let go because of COVID, you would qualify for unemployment insurance. That was really critical. And we did that on a self-attestation basis, but employers had to verify it as well on their end. We made some changes to the shared work program. This is an extraordinary component of the program that allows an employer to reduce hours for a number of workers versus just laying off a certain bucket of workers, just to keep workers attached to the workplace. That's so critical to get people reemployed after being on a period of unemployment insurance. We decreased the requirements to be in that program so that folks who are newer employers could also take advantage of that program in a way that was really important, I think, for workers and for businesses. And then we did a special relief of charges, again, for those reimbursing employers who had incurred debt that was, again, due to no fault of their own due to the pandemic from having to pay those charges into our system. So that was kind of what the state did. But of course, the biggest thing that almost everyone talked about and watched on the unemployment insurance front throughout the past few years has been what the federal government did. And the federal government did a number of things. The first, of course, the big one was increasing those benefit payouts by about $600 per week per worker from the period of January to August of 2020, from the spring and summer of 2020, and then $300 from the period of January to August of 2021. So this was meant to try to fill that gap, knowing that it only being a partial wage replacement and having millions of Americans out on the street based on the firings from COVID would have enough money to make ends meet. We extended a benefit program for people who had exhausted their regular UI benefits, so we lengthened the period of time you could get the benefits. And then there was the ability for folks who don't usually qualify because they're independent contractors or work on their own, or they're small businesses who don't use the system, to take advantage of the system as well, given the extraordinary challenges everyone faced. So we really kind of rethought as a nation the program for our workers and for businesses. We even went for a moment into FEMA and took some money from the FEMA funding to do a lost wages assistance program for a brief period of time at the end of 2020 as well. So it was really a massive shift in how we thought about this. We're really proud of the work we did collaboratively with this committee and the House to find ways to fill the gap for workers while the federal government tried to figure out whether they were going to be able to extend some of those programs. They ended up doing that, so that work wasn't necessary, but we really valued that collaboration to make sure Minnesota was there for our workers. And I'll just say, you know, we at the department are very fortunate to sit on a long legacy of Minnesota having a really well-run department. I know many of you had friends or relatives or neighbors in other states who found themselves, you know, filling out paper applications, waiting in line around the block to get in there and get payments. Minnesota was the first state in the entire country to implement all three major federal programs and get that money flowing to workers, and was consistently awarded awards for speed, for velocity, for low levels of fraud, and just a well-run program. That is testament to decades of investment in a strong program for our state. And really, it's what businesses thanked us for, workers thanked us for throughout the pandemic. It wasn't a perfect time, so many challenges, of course, but the program really did an extraordinary job of helping workers during a challenging time. To give a picture of that, this next graph is kind of stunning. You can see the jump in claims in 2020 that was really unprecedented. And we've compared this here to 2009, the last recession. You see there, nowhere near the amount of jump in claims at the time of calamity as we saw here at COVID and the pandemic. Just an extraordinary number of people claiming unemployment insurance. And again, almost one in five Minnesotans who did it. We are down today to about 80,000 Minnesotans who are receiving weekly benefits. But there was a period of time when we were in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. So it has shifted rapidly. But boy, that was a huge amount of stress that our system undertook. And I can proudly say we never once crashed our system. You had dozens of states whose systems literally crashed under the traffic. But Minnesota's was able to hold up. And we're grateful for that. And then just kind of by the numbers, you know, if you look at our COVID response and what it meant for Minnesota families. Again, 1.3 million applications came in, 873,000 Minnesotans received at least one payment of unemployment insurance, almost $15 billion flowed through our department. We get a lot of that, those federal benefits that came through, but an extraordinary amount of money. And we did the math on this recently. That's 17 times more money than you would usually expect to be issued during that same time period if it weren't for the pandemic. So an extraordinary amount of stress on the system, but, you know, really helped workers get through a challenging time. And just to kind of put that in perspective, that's about 350 million bags of groceries for families across the state. It's about 18 million rent payments for Minnesotans to get through this time. So just a critical part of how Minnesota weathered the past few years, program that we're proud to operate on behalf of the state, that we're grateful to have collaborated with you all on to make sure it adapted to the moment. And Chair, if it's okay with you, at this point, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Deputy Commissioner of Workforce Services, Evan Rowe, who'll go into a bit more detail about how the taxes work, because I know this committee will focus a lot on what we do next. And I think providing some of that more detailed foundation might be helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner Grove, and welcome to the committee. Mr. Rowe, please state your name for the record and feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. Senators, my name is Evan Rowe. I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services here at DEED, leading the unemployment insurance area, among others. And as Commissioner Grove said, I'm going to go into a little bit more of the weeds in terms of the UI tax structure, the trust fund, and a couple other items that I know that the committee wanted to have a presentation on and discuss a little bit. So these slides, you might call them content rich. I'm not going to read every word on every slide because I don't want you all to fall asleep in the afternoon. That being said, very happy to go in deep on any point here. If it's helpful, please feel free to just pause, or we can hold questions to the end, whatever is best for you. Really want to make sure that we're able to convey the information in the best way possible. And I believe you all have this document as a leave behind so that you can consult it as needed. So just to start out with, what we're kind of to talk through the overall structure for the state's UI tax system. The first thing to note is that a tax-paying business doesn't pay taxes on the full wages of an employee's salary. They only pay up to what's called the taxable wage base. So that's an amount that's $38,000 for calendar year 2022. That's indexed to the state's average annual wage. So it's a similar structure to, like, say, federal Medicare tax in that regard. You don't pay it on the whole piece, just that first $38,000. Then there's the base tax rate. That's the rate that every tax-paying employer who's in the UI system in the state of Minnesota pays. And that's a rate between 0.1% and 0.5% of that taxable wage base. So only up to that $38,000. And that rate changes based on the level of the unemployment insurance trust fund written in statute. So we'll cover that in a little bit more detail as we go on through the presentation. The second piece of kind of the core tax rate is what's known as the experience rate. And that's a rate that's based on based on a business's usage of the unemployment insurance program. Federal regulation and law requires that UI programs are experience rated. That if you use the program more, you pay more as a business. So you'll see the rates can vary from employer from 0% to 8.9%. Again, of that taxable wage base, so up to the $38,000. So, you know, in a high, you know, in an industry or in a business that has high turnover and frequent, you know, kind of frequent layoffs and uses the program a lot, they're going to be on the higher end. If there's a business that doesn't ever have layoffs, then they're going to be on the lower end of that. So that kind of is sort of a regulating mechanism to ensure alignment with the usage of the overall program. Next slide, please. Then there are two additional components which are sometimes you could say toggled on for the UI tax structure when the trust fund is not in as strong of a position, when it's basically below certain thresholds. And those are what are known as the additional assessment and the special assessment. Two different things, although they sound kind of similar. The additional assessment is essentially a surtax that is applied to the amount that's owed by an employer after the base and experience ratings. And its main purpose is to help the trust fund recover fall in the wake of a downturn. So when the trust fund is not in a strong net financial position, there are thresholds written into state statute that can trigger the additional assessment to help the trust fund recover back to a kind of more sustainable financial level. And I think it's noted in there's four rates for the additional assessment that are written in statute, each of which are triggered at different points of where the trust fund sits. Then there's a separate assessment known as the special assessment. And that's only activated when Minnesota owes a balance to the federal government. And it basically is used to help us pay interest on the balance that we might owe to the federal government. And we'll get into that section in just a second. But this is solely a tax that's helped to pay, that's used to pay back the interest on a balance that Minnesota has with the federal UI trust fund account in Washington. And that one is required to be set by the commissioner of MMB in consultation with the commissioner of BEAD. There's one other tax rate that's a federal tax. It's known as the federal unemployment tax, or FUTA. This one is kind of complicated. I won't spend a ton of time on it. For this one, the taxable wage base is only $7,000. So it's not the whole $38,000. It's only on that first $7,000 of income for an employee. Technically the tax is a 6% tax on that $7,000. However, as long as states are in compliance with federal law, the employers are granted a 5.4% credit, leading to a net rate of 0.6% on that first $7,000. However, if a trust fund is in deficit or other compliance measures are not met, the credit is reduced. So you see that 0.6% on the $7,000 trickle up kind of progressively in out years when those conditions aren't met. So again, I guess the way to think about it is each year that the trust fund is in deficit at a certain point in the year, you have the potential to lose that credit against it. Now, 0.3% on the first $7,000 is not a huge number, but it is still something that is worth considering and is certainly a factor in policy making. So we just wanted to make sure that we flagged that. Next slide, please. So we want to just provide a little bit of context in terms of the historic rates on the, or just a little bit of the trust fund history coming out of the Great Recession and how it worked with the overall tax mechanisms. Because the UI tax system and the trust fund are designed to be self-regulating and sort of inherently sustainable, in that they're meant to be self-correcting in the wake of a downturn. So what you saw, the big trend is you saw the trust fund dip below zero in 2009, 2010, 2011, during the depths of the Great Recession. And then you saw it start to recover in those out years starting around in 2011. Now, how did it recover? If you look down at that table, you'll actually see the rates themselves start to change in line with the position of the trust fund. So if you look at the base tax in 2008, 2009, it was at 0.4%. But in, you know, basically 2010 through 2013, that tax ratcheted up to 0.5% to basically help the trust fund recover. Additionally, you saw the additional assessments and special assessments get activated to help the trust fund recover and return to a more fiscally sustainable point. And that's largely how it occurred over the following years. And then as the trust fund began to recover in 2014, 2015, 2016, you start to see the additional assessment, the special assessment both toggle off, the base tax rate falls back down to kind of the lowest end that it can be at. So that then you're collecting less money because the fund is at a sustainable point. So just wanted to provide that context because we'll update the next slide. We'll have the graph with where we're at right now in the wake of the pandemic. But can I pause? Can I pause for a moment? If there are any, or should I keep going, Chair Pratt?
Unless anybody's got an immediate question, I think we can continue on. Great. Why don't we just continue on? Thank you.
Great. So where we are right now is, and this is a, I think this, you can kind of see in this image, really the effect that the pandemic has had on the trust fund. It's stark, I think would be one way to put it. In 2014, 2015, you see, and really it's kind of a stable level that the trust fund remained at from around 2015 through 2019. And then you can see the decline of the trust fund due to the demands on the fund as a result of the pandemic. Now, I think the question is how does that actually work? When the state's trust fund dips into falls below zero, what does that actually mean? We've got a little bit more context here around that. So how advances from the federal government work, when a state's trust fund goes into deficit, the state essentially draws money from the treasury in the form of an advance. And the technical term for this is a Title 12 advance, in case that phrase comes up. Think of this as a line of credit. And if you think about the collateral, it's the state's ability to levy unemployment insurance taxes. And it's something that is fairly common in a downturn. Many states in this pandemic and during the Great Recession borrow during a downturn. It's kind of part of the system because when you have large systematic events, oftentimes it takes a little bit longer for the result to be netted out over time. And again, repayment occurs when the receipts through the state's UI taxes exceed the benefit payments over time. And as you saw in the previous slide, this can take years in the case of a recession where there's continued demands on the program. How interest works on the borrowing is that it's charged monthly by the Treasury based on the average daily balance for the month. It's a rate that's set slightly above prime by Treasury. It's not negotiable, but it does change. The rate right now is about 1.59%, which is actually down from last year. USDOL sends the program a bill for interest at the end of each month, and we remit it. Congress waived interest from March 20 through September 2021. But they did not continue to waive interest following basically the end of the federal unemployment insurance programs. And just one thing that's worth noting, you can't pay interest with money that's in the state's UI trust fund. You have to pay that with the state funds, and that's again the purpose of the special assessment that I mentioned earlier. It's to explicitly pay for any interest payments. Next slide. What have other states done? There's been a variety of approaches to what other states have done relating to the trust fund and negative balances that they might have had. Some states have devoted some CARES and ARPA funding to UI but haven't repaid the Title 12 advances yet. Others have paid Title 12 advances, repaid any advances back to the federal government. but haven't paid anything additional into their state's UI trust funds. And others have repaid the Title 12 advances and refilled and added to their UI trust fund balances, generally to reduce tax impacts. And that's what's in the governor's budget. That's the proposal in the governor's budget. Again, I know we'll talk about that in subsequent hearings and whatnot. But there's a variety of different approaches that are being taken, and many states are kind of working through these questions as they're going into their legislative sessions. So that's kind of our current update on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. I'm happy to pause there if there are specific questions there, or we can, Chair Pratt, we obviously also happy to go on to reimbursing employers and fraud prevention, because I know the committee had some questions about that as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rowe, and maybe this is a good time to take a break and talk about the Unemployment Trust Fund in general. Does anyone have any questions? I'll start. You know, we talked about how much was paid out, and that we're, you know, we supplement the benefit is half of an employee's paycheck up to $820. But what was the average UI claim, excluding the federal supplements?
I would have to look back for that to get that data. I don't have that right in front of me, but would be happy to answer that.
I thought it was somewhere around $400 and something, so it was a pretty conservative amount. Mm-hmm. And then you did talk about the fact that compared to the Great Recession, our debt dipped down about twice as deep as it was back in 2008, 2009. And it looks like the interest rate changed. It was at about 2.2%. It's now down at a point and a half. Can you tell me when that changed and how much we're accruing in interest on a daily basis?
I think Treasury updates the interest rate monthly. It's declined a little bit again, basically since last fall, when I think it was about 2.2%. Over the course of the year, if we projected that there'd be about, you know, if the balance, you know, if there's no action taken to repay the Title 12 advance back to the federal government, we calculated last year that it would be about $22 million in total interest over calendar year 2022. Daily, there's variation, but that's kind of the aggregate expectation for the entire year, which is how we also set the special assessment chair.
So we're still having to dip into that line of credit as needed.
If you think about it, we take in receipts on really there's it's a very it's kind of lumpy cash flow it's you know it's a lumpy cash flow in the sense that taxes are due on or they're due quarterly, right? They're due on April 30th, June 30th, or July 31st, et cetera. So four times a year. So we pay benefits throughout that entire time period. Mm-hmm. So there's naturally some cash flowing that happens as part of that.
Okay. And how many other states still owe the federal government money on the UI Trust Fund? How many still have an outstanding debt?
Let's see. The last I checked, actually, I believe there's about 9 or 10 right now. I think just looking on the Treasury site, which is updated regularly. So California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Virgin Islands.
Okay. So about 10 states, including Minnesota, still owe the federal government.
Correct.
Do we have any other questions? Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rowe, it seems that a lot of these fees and other variables in the expenses that go with UI are articulated to the relative health of the trust fund as a whole. What is healthy, I guess, is the question. What amount has to be in the trust fund to designate something that you would consider solvent and healthy and adequate so that there isn't an undue burden placed on some of our businesses and the rest of our communities? And how is that calculated as well?
Chair Pratt, Senator Putnam, thank you for that question. It's a really good and a little complex question. So there's a couple definitions that we can kind of talk about. Let me first talk about what's in Minnesota statute. So the unemployment insurance statute, I think chapter 260, section 268.051, outlines the various financial thresholds at which the tax rates are triggered. And they're basically triggered at, and they're triggered at levels of, it's a percentage of wages of covered employment. So if you take all of the wages for all the jobs that we that the UI employ that the unemployment insurance system covers, it's a percentage of that. We've calculated, and that number is about to basically turn off all the additional tax rates. It's about $1.3 billion of a balance in the unemployment insurance trust fund. Sorry, I nearly went down a rabbit hole there, but call it $1.3 billion. It's sort of the state threshold at which additional taxes turn off. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, if I could just share it quickly here, because you saw the specificity in the budget recommendation from the governor being $2.73 billion. We are very confident in that number, and we're very confident that 1.3 is the amount needed to stave off additional taxes. And then by the time we reach that point, we'll be about $1.5 billion in debt. So when we did the math on that, it was both getting out of debt and then getting to that level, a confident level that we know we would not have to raise taxes on employers. So there's some complexity to the calculation we'd be happy to go into further, but we're extremely confident in that number and excited to discuss that with you further.
Thanks, Commissioner.
So Commissioner, just to take that point through our conversations, we're currently at about $1.2 billion in debt. We expect to potentially increase up to about $1.5 billion sometime in the quarter, and then as we'll be talking about paying off that debt at our next meeting, we can take that up. But Commissioner has been very helpful in sharing the governor's math with that and his department's work, so I appreciate it. Senator Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wondering if the agency has done any calculations or projections that if we do nothing, how long will it take to get back to solvency? And if we, say, pay off the debt, how long it might take to get back to that solvency level?
Mm-hmm. Chair Pratt, Senator Rare, thank you for that question. That's a really good question. I'll note one other wrinkle in this, which is that the legislature the current statute requires us to hold employers harmless from the effects of the pandemic so that experience ratings wouldn't change as a result of the pandemic. And that's a pretty big component of sort of the self-regulating mechanism of the fund. As a result, if we didn't, if action wasn't taken on this front, we would expect it would take the better part of the decade for the trust fund to recover back to a place where there wouldn't be any sort of incremental taxes placed on board. So it's a significant period of time. It's a little bit less, of course, if you just backfilled it, basically brought it back to zero. Still, 5 or 6 years thereabout. But that's just because the effects were larger, and some of the normal self-regulating mechanisms from the pandemic are we have to be thoughtful about. It would take a significant period of time.
And so, looking at page 13, it looks like it took us about 6 years to recover, 7 years to recover during the Great Recession?
That's about right. Yes, Chair Pratt, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Rowe? And Mr. Rowe, we're back to a kind of a normal unemployment, right? There's no more accommodations, no more extensions, no more supplements. We're kind of back to the program as originally designed.
Correct. So yeah, Chair Pratt, that's absolutely correct. The federal programs ended back in September of 2021, so that it's back to business as usual.
And you know, members of the committee, you'll remember that when we first started seeing this problem, we came back together along with the governor, and we proposed holding off the 1 week waiting period. We proposed and agreed with Deed to suspend temporarily the requirement to look for comparable work, because we knew that people were being furloughed for a very specific reason, and I just wanted to make sure that we were completely back to normal. So any other questions before we move on? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Rowe.
Great, thanks, Chair Pratt. We know that the committee also wanted to just a couple updates on reimbursing employers, which are the other set of employers, and a little bit on just fraud prevention, something we take really seriously and wanted to provide you with an update on. So everything that we were just discussing is about tax-paying employers at the state, and that is by far and away the majority of unemployment insurance customers or businesses in the state. That's about 130. There's about 135,000 tax-paying employers in Minnesota, but there are about 3,000 or so what we call reimbursing employers. Generally speaking, these are nonprofits, units of government, local, county, and state government. And hospitals in some cases as nonprofits. And the difference, and unlike taxpaying employers who, you know, kind of pay the base rate, experience rate, et cetera, reimbursing employers essentially pay what they pay back what they use. So they get a quarterly bill equal to the amount of the equal to the amount paid to former employees in the previous quarter. So unlike a taxpaying employer where it's sort of balanced out over time and that they draw from the UI trust fund, reimbursing employers bear the full immediate, you know, that full cost of UI benefits pretty much the quarter after a layoff occurs. Now, and then, you know, and if a reimbursing employer doesn't pay the full amount, then interest and penalties are applied. Ordinarily, all adjustments to benefit charges are completed before bills to the reimbursing employers are mailed. But part of the flip side of that is they generally, reimbursing employers usually have really stable UI expenses. They're, you know, oftentimes it's a nonprofit, think of it as a small nonprofit that, has a few employees. They don't have big UI bills, or a hospital system that's sort of able to budget, for something like that. So generally speaking, you don't see those huge swings. However, the pandemic, like many other things, sort of changed the rules of the game. And on the next slide, we can get into a little bit of the implications therein. Because as many of you know, nonprofits and other groups were hit very hard by the pandemic, particularly right at the beginning. So within about a month of the beginning of the pandemic, the CARES Act included a very generous, but also really complicated reimbursement to states for reimbursing employers. The full provisions are below, but there's essentially highly specific rules based on the period of time, based on which kind of time window, which weeks, et cetera, and employers. And the end result of that kind of complex program design meant that we couldn't fully implement that federal reimbursement program until after the quarter was over, and effectively until after the federal payments, the federal programs wrapped up in September of 2021. Additionally, in order to kind of do the math so that we made sure we were calculating an accurate bill, we really had to kind of run the math for the whole period of time leading up through the whole federal program period. However, now that the federal programs have wrapped up, we're able to begin resuming the billing for for reimbursing employers. That's going to start to come in the next several weeks. The thing I just want to emphasize is that they're only going to get billed for the things that weren't pandemic related and that weren't picked up by Congress, right? Again, in line with the legislature and the governor's, in line with the legislation and statute, they'll be held harmless just like taxpaying employers are being held harmless through this. And we're, Chair Pratt, to your point, we're sort of resuming the normal operations for reimbursing employers as well as everybody else. I'll pause there. That's the last slide I have on reimbursing employers.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Do we have any questions on reimbursing employers? Just a couple of questions, Mr. Rowe, and maybe one for the committee is, how does somebody, since a reimbursing employer is effectively a self-insured employer, how does one become a reimbursing employer? Does Deed have to go through and approve them? Could you just update the committee on that process?
It's an application process in the same way or that you go through the UI tax system and the accounts review to make sure that that a particular employer meets the eligibility requirement for having such an account. Sorry.
And typically a reimbursing employer, their employees would be paid out of the unemployment trust fund, but then but have to pay back the trust fund in the following quarter. Is that correct?
It's essentially we bill the employer back for their usage for the previous quarter.
And it says here you'll start that billing in the coming weeks. How long has it been since reimbursing employers have been asked to pay back the trust fund?
I'd have to take a look to get you an exact answer on that, Chair Pratt. But I think the key is that we really want to make sure that we're giving folks accurate bills. I think it's back to towards the start of the pandemic to make sure that we're really calculating things accurately given the changing guidance, the changing guidance and the updates from the CARES Act, et cetera.
And then I really like how you laid out the how reimbursing employers have been helped by Congress and the federal monies. Do you have any sense of how much of the trust fund? How much reimbursing employers owe back to the trust fund still after net of federal help?
I don't have that number because we're still I think we're still running the calculations there. One thing I would just note is it's a relatively small number of employers overall. Again, we've got about 135,000 taxpaying employers, about 3,000 reimbursing employers. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't describe proportionality there, but simply an order of magnitude for context.
No, I understand, and I'm just kind of curious and trying to get the lay of the land on it.
Certainly.
Any other questions on reimbursing employers? Okay, well, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Rowe, for that, and I think we're going to move on to the next topic.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. So we wanted to take a little bit to discuss fraud, because I know that's a frequent question that you get from your constituents, and it's a question that we get a lot. And we're really just kind of wanted to give an overview of how we approach this problem. Now, this is not going to be a deeply technical discussion, because in part we generally try to avoid talking about how we can conduct anti-fraud efforts in public, because we don't want bad guys to figure out how we are policing their behavior. But I'll speak generally, and if you have any questions, very happy to answer them. Right, and I think to start with, it's worth noting there's more than one type of fraud. Fraud can occur both on the applicant side and on the employer side. And we have tools in place to detect and prevent these efforts, and it's something we take really seriously, and that we're constantly working to enhance our efforts on that front. You know, if you're looking at the sort of buckets of fraud, right, when it comes to employers, you can have intentional underreporting or non-reporting of covered employment, right? You're basically trying to hide employees from the UI tax rolls. For applicants, it's underreporting or non-reporting income while receiving benefits. And just as a general point, I would say if you look at, you know, Department of Labor audits and other records on that front, Minnesota's UI program has compared very favorably to programs in other states, both in terms of accuracy of payments and anti-fraud efforts. And I'll just say that's a testament to the dedication and hard work of the public servants that work in the unemployment insurance division. It's a hard thing to get right, and they work very hard to get it right. But I think the type of fraud that's gotten a lot of attention lately is what's known as an imposter, and we've got a little bit of information about that that I'll just walk through. So I think, you know, throughout the pandemic, there's definitely coverage about some instances of identity theft, where people will use, you know, stolen information that they get from sources to fraudulently apply for federal or state UI benefits. And again, that's what we call an imposter. And this isn't a new thing, right? This has been a thing for a very long time. And it's not just a UI problem. It's a problem in the financial services industry. Any place that one can get access to money. I think the difference, of course, is that with the changes in the programs as a result of the pandemic, it just changed the target profile a little bit. The question then naturally comes up, well, how successful were they? What was really at stake? And, you know, in some states, there was certainly a fair bit of media reports that there were imposters that were more successful, you know, were at least initially more successful. And some, you know, some states reported that there were large dollar amounts. Now, what isn't totally clear even at this point is whether those are actual dollars lost rather than what would have been lost if you applied sort of a scalar percentage, an assumed rate, had they been successful. Some of this is just assumptions applied to a larger number. And I think in a lot of those states, they had older systems that were very dependent on kind of manual intervention, staff detection. And when the really big volumes hit in terms of the pandemic, in terms of the larger number of applicants that we had, they were less able to adapt to be able to manage that. Minnesota's approach has always used, you know, data analytics to detect imposter activity. And we were able, therefore, to scale really well to the increased levels of activity. On the next slide, you know, I think it's just worth noting that you know, generally speaking, these folks are using, you know, from what we know, you know, they're using data sets from the dark web to piece together identity information, not generally from a single source. You know, you're not going to find, you know, probably my whole personal life, but they can try to find enough pieces so that they can. That they can make it work. And what they really try to take advantage of is the scale of the pandemic and just the unprecedented demands that were placed on these programs. And again, as I said before, it's not necessarily just a UI thing. This is a thing that happens all across. The difference is that the nature of the UI program changed over time. And I think the key here for, you know, Minnesota and every other state is, if you're a Harry Potter fan, constant vigilance. As you're thinking through how you can stay on top of and against this threat, and making sure that we're constantly updating our tools and procedures to counteract malicious actors in that regard. You know, I think there's room for improvement in terms of the federal government and other partners, since it ties to the banking system, and it ties to the work that we do as well. So those are some general thoughts. I'm very happy to answer any questions, of course.
Okay.
Hey.
Sorry about that. Any questions regarding fraud for Mr. Rowe? Well, Mr. Roy, I think I've told the commissioner this. I spent probably about 10 years working in the financial services fraud space, so I'm somewhat familiar with it. And it seems like the imposter fraud, as you called it, is really a form of identity theft, and we've seen it on the tax side with the filing of fraudulent tax returns that have prevented Minnesotans from getting their refunds because they've already been stolen. And I can tell you that a number of members have come to me, at the height of the claims. People were getting letters saying that, their unemployment checks were coming and they hadn't applied. Employers were trying to find out what's going on. Is there an employer record that comes with the employee record that shows that there's a match there, or so that is, I mean, without giving away the secret recipe, it seems like there's some, that might be one basic avenue, and do you normally do that? And because of the high volume, was there a little bit of a breakdown in that process?
Well, what I'll just say, without going into too much detail here, and obviously, happy to have follow-up conversations as needed or as desired on this front to ensure program security. I think just as a general point, employers can see who is claiming unemployment, who is claiming benefits on their account, and that's something that they can review and verify. If you get the proverbial letter in the mail saying somebody's applied for unemployment benefits in your name, we want you to call us. We want you to tell us. We will take action to shut that down. Make sure that the employer is held harmless from that kind of activity, and make sure that we're keeping track of that. So I think those are all pieces of this, and every chance we have to catch that on that front is something that we certainly encourage people to report. Call the unemployment insurance call center. We have a lot of information on UI on the unemployment UI Minnesota website about reporting fraud and about making sure that people can. Let us know. So a lot of information on the website there. We really appreciate it when folks do that.
So I mean, we've heard estimates across the country that nationally, over $1 billion has been lost in UI fraud. You talked a little bit about it as far as run rates and what would have been prevented, but do you have an estimate overall on total dollars lost in fraudulent claims, put it in context?
It's a really tough question to answer in that regard, because Chair Pratt, I want to give like a good answer, but I think you can understand where the challenge in providing such an answer is, because you're making a lot of assumptions on a very large data set, and with a lot of uncertainty as well, right? I think what I can say confidently is that I think if you look at our record, if you look at Minnesota's record in comparison with a lot of around the country, I think we would compare very well in terms of the discipline with which we worked to adhere, with which we had worked to ensure that those kinds of activities were stopped as soon as stopped and didn't make it to the finish line. A hard number is tricky, but I appreciate the question, and I really do.
We should have some sense of how many fraud claims were filed, mm-hmm. And I know that when I worked in fraud, it was, we looked at least on the credit card side, it was fraud losses as a percentage of sales. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming you have some sort of metric in fraud claim with that, and maybe you can get that to me offline, and I would appreciate it.
We certainly keep records on those on both reported fraud and elements like that. So that's something maybe that might be best. We'd be very happy to brief you offline for that.
Great.
Chair Pratt, if I could just interject a point here.
Yeah, Senator Grove, okay, Commissioner Grove.
Evan's absolutely right. I would just add to that one of the challenges of any eligibility program, and I think we've shared it here, is that there's always some fraud. Like there's just always some fraud in every space like this. What we saw during the pandemic on the imposter fraud front was it remained below 1%, which is the usual rate it usually is in normal times, and didn't markedly go up. So while the overall number of applicants in there was larger, so you're looking at larger amounts of fraud just in the net, from a percentage standpoint, it remained around the same. There are states where that wasn't true. There are states where that percentage really jumped, and we were able to keep our kind of always on fraud percentages really, really low. Mm-hmm. But it takes to the Harry Potter reference earlier, constant vigilance. It's not something that we ever take for granted. And I'll say that we did some new things, again, things we wouldn't share here during this pandemic, to really lock it down during a time where we knew we would be more attacked. So it's important to be always reimagining how you attack this space, especially when there's a lot of attention on it.
No, having been involved in it for about a decade, I know that it's always a challenge, and you know, we always shot to have about 0.1% of our losses of our sales go to fraud losses. But Senator Housley, you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably for Commissioner Grove. Did DEED apply for any of the state grants that were set aside in the federal ARP dollars for unemployment identity verification or fraud prevention?
Commissioner Grove.
Chair Pratt, Senator Housley, as it relates to those grants, I'd have to check. I don't believe that we did. We had, as we began this pandemic, already begun a technology improvement project to vastly upgrade our unemployment insurance system. And believe it or not, we're able to continue to do that work during the time of the pandemic. So very soon you'll see unemployment insurance on mobile phones and other languages, a much more effective system. But I don't believe we applied for any additional grants for fraud prevention. I'd have to double check that, but I believe largely because we didn't feel that we needed it, given where we were at with preventing fraud.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner. I'm just wondering, how many states did? Why didn't we? Did we know how much was available to apply for? If you could get that information to us, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to do that. And this is not, this is an area I'd love to dig in a little bit deeper. We may have applied for some of it, but I want to get you the best answer possible. So let us circle back on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Housley. Senator Rurick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on that fraud regard, then, would you believe that there's no real need to be looking back, that anything that was able to be caught, you've caught it at this point, or is there still some ongoing investigations looking back?
Chair Pratt, Senator Rurick, thanks for the question. I think let me know if this answers the question. I think a lot of UI fraud kind of tends to be in the moment, right? You know, people, you know, they get access to a fraudulent identity and try to use that to collect payments in the moment. So I think a lot of what we're trying to do is stop it before it happens. Obviously, I think there's also a constant element of reviewing best practices and making sure that we're always looking back and making sure that we're learning from every single kind of from every single moment that we can. So I think it's a little bit of both and. We want to stay focused on current inbound items, but we certainly are constantly reviewing our procedures and our approaches to make sure that we have a robust and resilient system.
Thank you. Senator Housley, you had another question.
I did, Mr. Chair. I was just sitting here thinking, and I was wondering, is there any regular reporting on unemployment insurance fraud or anything published publicly or a report submitted to the legislature?
Chair Pratt, Senator Housley, the Department of Labor does track this on a national basis. I think that's probably the best source of some of those data. We can certainly point you to where those reports are.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for Commissioner Grover, Mr. Rowe? Seeing none, I just want to thank the department for coming. This was a good start. We'll be talking about unemployment on Monday, and we'll actually have a bill hearing that we'll want to pass out. So, Commissioner, we're hoping that you and your team will be participants in that discussion as well. And looking forward to continue to working on it. It's certainly, as I say, it's maybe because of the committee that we're on, but it's probably the number one issue that I hear about from particularly from my Main Street businesses, the restaurants, the small manufacturers, those folks that are seeing anywhere from, I think, Commissioner, you said the average increase was around 30%, but we've heard them, north of 100%. We talked to somebody yesterday that's telling me their UI bill is going up 155%. So this is important for us as we start talking about workforce shortages and getting people back into the economy, as we start talking about really helping these businesses that have suffered for 2 years kind of be able to rebound. I think this is going to be a really good launching pad for us to start. And appreciate the commissioner's work and partnership throughout the interim as we've talked about this. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just thank the committee for having us. We're eager to be here, eager to help. I suspect we're on very much the same page on this issue, as I think you can see from the governor's budget. So we're eager to collaborate and help these Main Street businesses that Senator Pratt mentioned. So thanks so much.
Okay, well, if there's no other business to come before the committee, we'll stand adjourned until Monday at 3 o'clock. Thank you.